Today at Reader's Corner, Oscar-winning actor George Kennedy, author of Trust Me, a memoir.
The tragedy of the Big Depression was that there was no place to go. You had no home. We had World War II waiting. We were all kids. You're there, you shoot, they shoot at you. The lucky ones get a Bronze Star, the unlucky ones get a 6-foot hole in the ground. Movies have a lot to do with what's happening at the time. It's a precise business. It has to do with how many pages a day. It doesn't have to do with people stealing scenes.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Hollywood autobiographies can often be self-serving exercises in which the authors leave little room for anything other than name-dropping and gossip. But today's guest, Oscar-winning actor and Eagle, Idaho resident George Kennedy, chose a model much more down-to-earth and authentic. His recent book, Trust Me, a Memoir, leaves readers feeling less like eavesdroppers on the lives of Tinseltown's elite and more like they've just had an engaging, warm conversation with an introspective friend. Mr. Kennedy is perhaps best known for his Academy Award-winning role as the convict Dragline in Cool Hand Luke. He has more than 200 films to his credit, including roles in The Dirty Dozen, the Airport series of the 1970s disaster movies, and as Captain Ed Hocken in the Naked Gun series of comedy films in the 1980s. His TV credits include The Andy Griffith Show, Perry Mason, Bonanza, McHale's Navy, Dr. Kildare, Gunsmoke, Dallas, Wings, and The Young and the Restless. In his memoir, Mr. Kennedy offers a refreshing perspective on a remarkable 3 decades of Hollywood history and the personalities that drove it. And he joins us in the studio today, not far from his home in Eagle, Idaho, where he lives with his wife, Joan. George Kennedy, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bless your heart. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, when I heard I was going to interview you, the very first thing I thought of was, at least for me, one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in any comedy over the years, and it was from the Naked Gun series. And you and Frank were apprehending a small-framed man in either a reception or a dinner, and you were holding this guy, and Frank comes right up against him and starts to frisk him. But as it turns out, he's really not frisking the bad guy. His hands are reaching into your pockets. First, he pulls out a gun, and he says, "Ah, there, proof, this guy's the bad guy." And then he goes to the other pocket, and he pulls out a wallet, and he picks up the wallet. And, of course, he thinks he's got the bad guy's wallet. He's got your wallet. He picks it up, and he said, "Ed, he's got your wife's photo." And, of course, there's dozens of scenes in that movie where you and Frank are just hilarious. I mean, it had to be a real kick doing something like that. Maybe we should start with the question you always want to ask an actor. How many takes does it take to pull off a scene like that? How many times do you have to do that?
Oh, that's the rub. The brothers, the geniuses, if you will, but, a little bit off of the track. But they're marvelous guys. But one flaw that the shooting schedule had is that they never settled for 1 or 2 takes. They always shot 40 takes. Now, accept that just the way it is, it's bad enough. But Leslie, we all carried part of it, but nobody carried more of it than Leslie did. And when you have done something, especially with business in it, and you have to do it 40 times and do it exactly the same way 40 times. I remember there were evenings, mornings at 2:30 in the morning. We were down in the harbor in San Pedro in Los Angeles, and Leslie and I were walking to our cars because we were right at San Pedro. And he bumped into me. He said, "I'm sorry, George." I said, "I'm sorry. I'm surprised you noticed." He was dead, because he was, regardless of how kind were it to O.J. and I and the others. It was Leslie. Leslie worked his buns off. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of O.J., for those who don't remember the Naked Gun series, O.J. was Nordberg, as I remember. And, of course, O.J. went on to get into a heap of trouble, and, of course, he's in prison right now. Did you have a friendship with O.J., and was there ever any time after that?
Yeah, as much as you could. What happens is O.J. becomes two people. He becomes the guy that you work with, a very pleasant guy, and he and I giggled a lot because we had lots of things where you had the head keep turning and what have you, and people loved it. But then when you'd have lunch together, and he and I, let's say the three of us were having lunch together, you'd find that that's a different O.J. that people come up to visit with at the table. I don't mean that Juice was a snob. He wasn't. He was a very likable guy, and he was probably, I told him one day, you forget the Juice. You are O.J. You are not just another actor. You are a guy that Hertz is paying you an arm and a leg to run through airports and
right.
stuff like that. So you're a bigger deal than even you think you are, and I think he was.
Well, let's go back to George Kennedy's beginnings. I got a real kick out of the fact that you were actually the ventriloquist dummy when you were 2 years old. Mm-hmm. You were on the stage, and this guy needed somebody to sit there and talk to and have talk back to him. And I think you were all of, what, 2 years old when you played that role?
No, we're much younger. The first stage appearance I made was on a vaudeville stage. There was a cartoon comic strip called Bringing Up Father. And what would happen is the act would be introduced, come out and sit in a chair. They pushed me, 2 years old, pushed me out on the stage. I walked over to his lap. He picked me up. And then, in effect, he talked to me, but for both of us,
right.
like a ventriloquist. So it was like my mother was a piano player. My father was an orchestra leader. And if anybody ever had a nudge in the right direction, it had to be me. I loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved it. That's all I can say.
You talked about your mother and father. You had a tough childhood. I mean, your book really opens up and tells the real life story of George Kennedy growing up. You lost your father at a very young age. Tell us the story of what happened after your father dropped dead and you and your mother were left.
It was probably, maybe next to the Civil War, America's worst time. The Big Depression was so ugly, so ugly, awful, so demeaning, so everything. There was no place to go. Those pictures that you saw from 29 of people on the street getting a bowl of soup, the only thing you had to do after that was to go around again, wait 2 hours and get another bowl of soup. The tragedy of the Big Depression was that there was no place to go. You had no home. Cops would look the other way on park benches. Hotels would sometimes let you sit in the lobby. But it was awful. And to just get any kind of a job or any kind of anything was wonderful.
You and your mother were homeless.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Well, it was like there was nothing. I can remember being with my mother walking day after day because there was no place to go. She would walk. I'd say, Mom, I did it one time. I said, can't we take a taxi cab? And she hit the roof. It was like demeaning. It was demeaning beyond the concept of it. There was no dignity. There was no anything.
Well, and then later on, I understand you and your mother were taken in by a woman, and that was not a good experience, I gather.
She had to sell her body at a house that we had to live in. We lived in the upstairs attic. But I very seldom saw a mom because she went on call when she went on call, and that's what she did for a living. And we ate whatever was left over from the people in the house. And then luckily for her and for me, she had a policeman marriage. And she knew the man, but not well. and she married him. And then all of a sudden, we moved uptown. We moved three blocks and lived on, I think it was 38th Street. Not to get boring about it, but all of a sudden, my mother had a man, a cop that had been on the service for 27 years, but she had a meal ticket, and we had a little dump of a flat. I heard my first radio, an Atwater Kent radio. I listened to the radio. They were such good programs. Jack, Doc, and Reggie were the big heroes of it. My point being, all of a sudden, we had somewhere to go. And that, I think, meant more to me at the age of 5, 6, 7 than anything in my life. World War II was World War II, but that, living through that depression was the worst.
Well, as I remember it, you spoke fondly of your stepfather in the book.
I did. He was not a well-educated man. He was just a good man. And he took care of my mother. And if he had done nothing else in his life, when it came time for the big judge up in the sky to put that gavel down, they're going to give high marks to him.
You're listening to George Kennedy, and we're talking about his memoir, Trust Me. Well, you did find a way to escape the misery of the Depression, and that, of course, was World War II when you enlisted and went on into the Army. Let's start with your general reaction to what kind of adjustment it was to Army life, and then we'll talk about your experience in the Battle of the Bulge.
I don't know how to compare things. Mind you, when the Depression came, Mr. Hoover was on his way out as president. Mr. Roosevelt was on his way to 4 straight elected offices. And what did you have? Well, after that lovely, delicious, enlightening, enchanting Depression, we had World War II waiting on December 7th, 1941. And we were all kids. I'm pointing to myself now. I'm 87 years old. But the kid that went into the service was a kid. I was a baby, and so was the guy next to me and everywhere else. And they were shooting at us. What are they shooting at us? Well, we knew, but it didn't make it any better.
Well, you took 2 Bronze Stars away from that war.
Yeah. Well, you're there, you shoot, they shoot at you. The lucky ones get a Bronze Star. The unlucky ones get a 6-foot hole in the ground. You know, war is not like it is on the History Channel, exactly. You're out there with guys that you may know well, may not know at all. You're just out there. You hear ping, 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 and a guy drops, and you never see him again. Or you drag him, and somebody puts a bandage on him, what have you. It wasn't like Audie Murphy, not the real Audie Murphy, but really Audie Murphy won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he was some kind of soldier. But the idea is that you're standing there talking to her, and all of a sudden his head is gone. That's not for 18-year-old, 19-year-old. It's like these beautiful kids that you have on the campus here today, every day. You don't want to see them chopped up. You don't really want the bad guys to get chopped up either, but it's what you do. Point at him and shoot.
Was it difficult taking on the role of General Patton years later as an actor?
I did play General Patton, but not in the big Patton picture. I played it in Brass Target. I was Patton. Now, it wasn't a massive success because the Patton picture won and still is winning everything. But it was reviewed very well, and I got good reviews. Mm-hmm.
So you leave the service and you head for the Phil Silvers Show, where you are featured in the film. What does that do? That kind of helps you develop interest in film and the rest of your career, I would assume.
Well, luck has a great deal to do with it, but movies have a great deal to do with timing. If there's a picture coming up that fits you, and they talk to you, and they audition you, and all of a sudden they say, hey, wait a second, Kennedy. Yeah, I saw him in a Gunsmoke. He could do this great because he talks German, blah, blah, blah. You just have to go and hope that the flow is in your direction when they're hiring.
Well, you actually didn't leave the Army after the war. You spent a number of years working.
I didn't have any place to go. When I went into the service, I was enlisted, drafted, just the same as anybody else. And immediately I went into infantry training, and immediately I went into combat in Europe. And then it was over, and I was going to come home. And wouldn't you know, when I got to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and they were going to release me from the service, there was a recruiting guy that said, "George, why are you getting out now? You're a staff sergeant. You get a good chance of going to OCS because you get medals, you did that and the other thing." So a fast-talking recruiting sergeant talked me into recruiting, and I went to OCS, and I went to Japan, and I went to Korea. So when I was retired because of all the things that are wrong with me, it was like I had never gotten out of the service from the time I was 18, and when I finally everything gave up. But we're sitting here, and it's like, wow, it all happened so quick. It didn't. But it was after all of that I got a chance to do Hollywood, and that was a break.
Well, let's talk about that break. Most of the people who think of George Kennedy think of the Oscar-winning role in Cool Hand Luke. How'd you get that job?
Well, the director was having trouble casting not the Paul Newman part. It was Paul Newman's picture, was and always will be. But what he did was that Newman was money in the bank. All the rest of the prisoners, including the part that I was up for, were like guys to help Newman be the great star he was. And so when they gave me a screen test, it was on a Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, I did it as best as I could, and Rosenberg was the first one to come over. He said, "Don't plan any trips, you know. When the director tells you you're it, you can smile all the way home."
Well, obviously the most famous scene of that movie was Paul Newman eating, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 eggs. At least that's what the film was portraying.
It turned out that way. It turned out that he probably ate 8-10 eggs. But Newman, he would put 3-5 eggs in. But the minute Mr. Rosenberg said cut, there were cans and barrels all over the place. Huh? He was right over there.
Throwing
them
out.
In 3 days, he might have eaten to a total of 8 or 9 eggs. Yeah. 3 or 4 scenes that were significant. Later on in the picture, he plays the banjo. Now, Newman, being the perfectionist as he is, he sits on a bunk. And we had to do it 3 times because Paul wanted to play it. You just don't pick up a banjo and play it. But by God, after 3 weeks of trying, we sat there one morning and he played it. And near the end, he blew a couple of chords, right? Newman being Newman, he got furious. He wanted it to be perfect. And eventually it was. But that was one. The girl washing the car was, it was grotesque. It was so funny.
Now, you have a reputation as a guy who did a lot of his own stunts. You did many of your stunts?
He and I almost did all. The reason was, when you get Paul Newman in a picture, you want Paul Newman on the screen, not some guy faking it by turning his face away from you like that. So Newman is hard to, what they call, paint around. Nobody is quite as good an actor as Newman was either. We shot that fight scene for 3 days. And we were both very tired by the end of the 3 days. So near the end of it, he winds up, and I said, whisper. I said, "Hit me." No, I wasn't being masochistic.
Right.
I was telling him, "Just get this thing over with." You know?
Right.
So he tried, but he's too much of a professional to want to hurt anybody. So we got through it. But you do, you get to a point of exhaustion. You're out of it and everything. You just want to get it done with.
Sure. Well, that movie, managed to get George Kennedy a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Did your career change substantially after the Cool Hand Luke Oscar?
Cool Hand Luke changed it immediately. I was working on a picture called The Boston Strangler, came to work one day. The first guy that saw me on the set was Henry Fonda. He said, "Congratulations." I said, "What?" I had just gotten there. He said, "You just got nominated for the Academy Award." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "Yeah." And everybody came around and, you know, well, what did it mean? I mean, it meant a whole salary, not a difference. It was wonderful. The picture that I had finished just a couple of weeks before had paid me total, all allowances and everything else, $20,000. When Henry Fonda told me this, that morning, within a half an hour, I signed for a $75,000 picture starting in 2 weeks.
There's the answer to my question.
Well, you know what the thing is? Here, you, in this marvelous school, as hectic as it must get from time to time, you're used to the sanity of 8 o'clock in the morning leads to. It's not like that in movies. Yeah. There is a schedule. You will adhere to that schedule. You will do it your best, or the next time they cast a picture, you ain't in it. It's a peculiar, awkward to be, say, "I'm going to act so good in this scene, I ain't even going to know you're up there." Well, you mean it, but you don't mean it. Mm-hmm. You don't hate anybody.
Well, you're listening to George Kennedy. He's the Oscar award-winning actor. He's from Eagle, Idaho these days. And we're talking about his memoir, Trust Me. You played in the early part of your career a lot of heavies, the bad guy. And sometimes you were out of the movie long before it was over. And then later on, you would end up playing the hero who dies the heroic death. And then after that, of course, getting back to Naked Gun, it's all about comedy. It's a remarkable, versatile career. I wonder if you could comment on whether or not you were ever worried, and did playing the heavies affect your ability to move into the heroic places or even the comedy?
It's a marvelous question, because it's not one that's asked a lot. Movies have a lot to do with what's happening at the time. You find out that Howard Hughes is making a movie, and you say there's a part in it for a big guy. Well, number one, there aren't that many parts for big guys in movies. The average leading man, and I don't mean this in any fingers in my nose way, the average leading man is 5'6". Not much over what have you.
Tom Cruise comes to mind.
Yeah, well, Tom Cruise is always the butt of the joke. But there's a lot of guys shorter than Tom Cruise, and there's a lot of guys that are not as good an actor as he is. But picture, if you will, six guys coming into a room. And there's Tom Cruise, and there's this guy, and there's this guy. And then there's George Kennedy, who comes in, who's a foot and a half taller than everybody there. The whole balance goes out of it. You go, "Where's George?" No, you don't. And so it's a precise business. It has to do with how many pages a day. It doesn't have to do with people stealing scene. The best way you can steal a scene is do it as best as you can. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Any roles you got stuck in where, in retrospect, you're thinking, "Boy, would I like to stay out of that one?"
Pointless statistic, really.
Right.
Some of them are really bad. I mean, you can be stuck in it. It's not necessarily you, and sometimes it is, but it's...
So tell us about Jimmy Stewart. You worked with Jimmy Stewart?
Greatest hero of my life. Yeah. I didn't have a father. I really didn't have a stepfather. I met Jimmy Stewart. We became very good friends, and I wish to God, if I had ever been lucky enough to have a father, it could have been Jimmy Stewart. Best, finest man I ever knew in or out of the movies.
So I'm reading along in your book, and all of a sudden there's a couple of pages on Dean Martin, who of course is known mainly for his beautiful voice over the years, his crooning. But there was also some movies he was in. And were you in movies with Dean Martin?
Lots of them. Dean was, if you can go back, I know you can, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were a team. I never felt personally that the best part of the team got the best part of the billing. Jerry Lewis was all right, but it always seemed to me that he did too much. On the other hand, you had Dean, his partner. He never did too much. Dean added to anything that he did. By the way, John Wayne was every bit as big a hero as you thought. You never forgot you were sitting next to a chair next to Wayne. Never. You know what was peculiar when I first started with them, when I started working on that group? Dean could really move a horse. Duke Wayne obviously could ride because he had been a stuntman before he was anything else. But when I think of Wayne and Randolph Scott, for that matter, and I think of them almost being one with the animal. You won't see any stand-ins when Dean goes galloping off somewhere.
How about yourself? Were you pretty good on the horse?
I learned to be. You saw me walk in here. Well, I've been that way for 17 years. I have not been able to walk without a stroller or walker. You know what happened, though? This is the last thing, but I'll tell you the truth. Everything I've told you is the truth. I miss it. I miss not the big pay. You miss that. But I miss them. I miss talking to them between the shots. I miss doing fight scenes, knowing that Wayne is never going to hit me by mistake. Knowing you give him a bat in his hand, and he'll miss your nose by an eighth of an inch. You see him where he says, "Now listen to me, son. You go," and he does Don Wayne, and it's wonderful. And all of those actors that worked in the John Ford Stock Company, they made it a blessing to be part of.
Well, we just can't say enough for what it means to those of us who followed your career that you would sit down and take the time over these recent years to write it all out. And the one thing in the book that I haven't discussed here on the air is there's reference, and it's really not in the book, but I did some homework on you. I checked out a few other sources.
You do homework all the time.
And I was very interested in the biographies, because in every one of the bios on George Kennedy, there's mention of the fact that you were one heck of a nice guy to work with and one of the most likable folks in Hollywood who really didn't know what it was like to have anything but a friend who you acted with. And the Oscar is one thing, but it's awfully nice to take away from a career the fact that you were so beloved by your fellow actors and actresses. And I think, again, that comes through in the book because you're throwing all these bouquets to all these people you've worked with, and you've just stated so eloquently how you miss them. But I'll tell you what, if they were around here and they couldn't come to Eagle, Idaho, they'd miss you too. And I just want to thank you for coming on to the show. This is a great privilege of mine. I've probably seen every one of those films you've been in, and they're a part of my life and a part of my family's life in so many ways. Thanks for being who you've been and who you are. George Kennedy, thank you for joining us today.
Please give my respects to your family. That was lovely. And this interview is lovely.
Next week, Bruce Barcott, author of The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird. The book is this year's first-year read at Boise State. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.